It's my great pleasure to welcome you here today. This is the 8th annual Danilo Husar-Struk Memorial Lecture, which was founded, indeed, the idea came very shortly after Danilo's death in 1999, founded to honor his memory, of course. And Danilo Struk is a man whose memory deserves to be recognized. Danilo Struk, as many of you know, was a very prominent Ukrainian scholar, certainly best known for his work as editor of the English language Encyclopedia of Ukraine, a project which he completed in print, but which continues as an active project at CIUS. But Danilo was, of course, also a scholar, a literary scholar, and a professor of Ukrainian literature and language at this university. We honor not just his memory, but his passionate interest in Ukrainian literature. And so I'm particularly grateful to you because I know this is the audience that is most peculiarly interested in that topic, an audience of select, if not numerous, participants. We have had a rather distinguished list of speakers in this series. I should be careful, since I gave last year's talk, so I'm just praising myself. But we've had, over the many years that we've now been doing this series, certainly some of the most prominent names in Ukrainian literary studies. Marko Polishin has delivered the Struk lecture, George Grabovich has delivered the Struk lecture, Oleg Linitsky has delivered the Struk lecture, and others. And in that long and distinguished, perhaps not that long, it's not a 40-year tradition yet, but we hope to get there, in that distinguished tradition, we welcome another important scholar of Ukrainian literature today. It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Miroslav Shkandry of the Faculty of German and Slavic Studies at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. Professor Shkandry is a major figure in North American Ukrainian studies. He's the author of a number of well-known monographs. You have no doubt read many of them, if not all of them. He has written on such topics as Mykola Khvilyuy. He has written on Ukrainian modernism and Marxism. Why don't I tell you some of his titles? That is Modernist, Marxist, and the Nation, the Ukrainian Literary Discussion of the 1920s. Russia and Ukraine, Literature and the Discourse of Empire from Napoleonic to Postcolonial Times. Then the collection of Khvilyuy pamphlets, The Cultural Renaissance in Ukraine, edited by Miroslav. He is also the author and the curator, I guess, of the exhibit and its catalog, The Phenomenon of the Ukrainian Avant-Garde, 1910 to 1935. He was recently here in Toronto giving a talk on a topic that he has recently taken up, David Burliuk, the artist. And in fact, I understand that Miroslav has another monograph forthcoming on Ukraine, on Jewish topics in Ukrainian literature, if I'm right. Is that?
Jews in Ukrainian culture.
Jews in Ukrainian culture. And so, without further ado, I welcome our speaker who will speak to us today on Dokia Humenna's memoirs. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here, all the more so since Danilo Stuck was one of my professors when I was a student at the University of Toronto. I have fond memories of this university, this city, and this community, so it's nice to be back. This is going to be a difficult subject. It's not an easy subject at all for Ukrainians or for Jews. I think I should explain how I got into studying this book and Doki Ahumenna. It's going to be grim and dismal, so maybe I'll begin with get the humor out of the way first. I'll tell you an anecdote. This is a true story. I have a friend, he may well be a friend of yours too, called Peter Matalainen in Edmonton. One day Peter was in Montreal looking for directions, and he turned to an obviously Jewish man to ask directions to where he was going. And the man gave him directions and said, you're not Jewish by any chance, are you? Now, Peter Matalainen is of Finnish origin. His parents came from Finland, and he's from Thunder Bay originally. So Peter said, no, I'm not Jewish. The old man said, well, are you sure you're not Jewish? You look very Jewish. And Peter said, no, I'm not Jewish. And the old man said, you know, you shouldn't be ashamed of being Jewish. Peter says, no, I'm not Jewish, I'm Finnish. The old man shook his head very sadly and said, you know, you can't finish being Jewish. That's a true story. It's a true story from Peter. So just as Jews have certain sort of obsessions and certain identity marking moments, Ukrainians do too, and very often Ukrainians are linked. These important moments in Ukrainian history, in Ukrainian literature, are linked to Jews. I got interested in this subject because it kept coming up. And I was amazed to discover that there's so little written about Jews in Ukrainian literature, Jews in Ukrainian culture. You know, Jews and Ukrainians have been arguing for 1,000 years. The first chronicles written 1,000 years ago already record arguments between Christians in Kiev and Jews. There, at the turn of the 20th century, one third of all Jewry lived in what today is Ukraine. And Ukraine is the only place where one third of Jewry lived either in villages, in rural settlements, or very close to villages. Ukrainians have a very close, a very intense relationship with Jews. And I was concerned to break down certain misconceptions. For example, the misconception that these were two solitudes, that these two communities never communicated, that they had very little in common, that they lived separate lives. So I got interested in this, and I've written a book, which I hope will be out in the next 6 months to a year, about Jews in Ukrainian culture. One of the problems, though, is that we live with the perspective of the Holocaust. We live looking back on this history through the prism, through the filter of what happened in 1919, during the pogroms, and in 1941, during the Holocaust. This literature of 1941, I think, needs to be more thoroughly analyzed, more thoroughly thought about. And I searched for descriptions of what happened. And that's how I found Doki Ahumenna. To my mind, her work is the best account of 1941 and one of very few that really raises provocative and interesting questions. Plus, I think we owe it to that generation, the generation, the post-Second World War generation, to take their literature, what they wrote, a lot more seriously. I think, ignored much of that literature. Much of the memoir literature of the post-Second World period has never been analyzed, has never been collected, has never been thoroughly described even. So these are all reasons why I got interested in Dukhya Humenna. Well, the account I'm going to talk to you about is Khrushchaty Yar, 1941 to 1943, Roman Chronika, she calls it, a novel chronicle. It was published in 1956. It describes occupied Kiev and focuses very heavily on the early months of the German invasion, devoting half its pages to the period from June until December 1941. As you know, this is a very controversial time, and remarkably little documentation exists on this in Ukrainian literature. The novel is particularly interesting because of the amount of attention it devotes to Jews. Now, it's less well known that there is also a diary that Humenna kept from 1941 to 1943, and this diary is the basis on which the novel is written. The diary is 302 pages long. It has never been republished. I found it in the Osredok, Ukrainian Cultural and Educational Center in Winnipeg. And, you know, in those days, they would type several copies through a carbon copy. So maybe 3, 4, maximum 5 copies could be made. This looks as though it might have been the third or the fourth copy. So there might be a couple more copies around. And on the pages, some pages are missing, and it says, these pages were sent to the journal Kerma. I found the first issue. I don't think the second ever appeared. I don't know if these pages ever were published. So until I find these pages, I am assuming that none of this diary actually has appeared. Why is the diary important? Because it treats the period with a lot more frankness, a lot more openness than does the novel. The novel was written between 1946 and 49, in the 3 years following the war. Humenna emigrated to New York, and that's where it was published. Some of the personal names in the diary are given explicitly. They are thinly veiled under pseudonyms in the novel. Also, there's a significant difference in tone and message, which suggests that she was rethinking what she had written in the diary. Let me first characterize Humenna for you. Her point of view can be summarized in general terms as follows. First of all, she's a woman writer and a civilian. She's anti-Soviet and anti-Nazi. After being heavily criticized in the early 30s for things that she wrote and said, Humenna was effectively banned from writing throughout the 10 years leading up to the war. During this time, she could not publish. She was treated as a pariah by many fellow writers. However, although she showed defiance towards the regime, she was blacklisted, she was never imprisoned. She, in fact, in the diary, describes herself in the 30s as a true believer, a youthful idealist, one who complained that a segment of the population, which included the leadership of the Writers' Union, was living a life of luxury as a privileged caste. And she, as a true believing communist, felt this was unjust. She was punished for this. Now, in 1941, when the war breaks out, she has no further illusions about the regime. She's embittered against the Soviet system, which she considers hypocritical, corrupt, brutally repressive, and she's particularly scornful of leading writers. This critique of Soviet literary life, especially in the 20s and 30s, received a fuller expression in her four-volume Dite Chumatskoe Shlyakhu, Children of the Milky Way, which was also written after the war and published in 1948. in general, she was enormously productive throughout the 40s. It was almost as though she had been released from silence, and she was driven to bear witness to the experience of her generation. Now, the writer was also anti-Nazi, and she was critical of various nationalisms, including the OUN-type nationalism, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. She was opposed in principle to any racism, any authoritarianism, any elitism, and she applied this criticism consistently to all regimes, all ideologies. For example, Humena complained of the narrow-minded, caste-like attitudes of those Ukrainians who had arrived from Central European countries and Galicia in the wake of the Nazi invasion. So she was angered by the self-appointed nationalist leadership in literature. This means Olena Peliha's circle, viewing them as newcomers who considered themselves aristocrats of the spirit, Nietzscheans, and thought that they were predestined to play star roles in the new Ukraine, the new Ukrainian culture, the new Ukrainian literature. She thought, and this is how she expressed her criticism, she thought them they were half-baked and arrogant. Now, these are the first impressions in the diary. They're a bit toned down in the novel, because by the end of the war, other things had happened. She was aware of other complexities. And she pointed out, among other things in the novel, that Peliha died a heroic and tragic death at the hands of the Gestapo. This general characterization of Humena would not be complete without mentioning her sympathy for a particular kind of feminism, one that she linked to her fascination with ancient cultures, especially the Tripilian, 5,000 to 3,000 BC, and the Scythian, 700 to 200, 700 BC to 200 AD, and with the matriarchal traditions that have left a powerful trace in Ukraine. The author read very widely on the subject of ancient cultures. In the 30s, I mean, she was essentially out of a job, she became an amateur archaeologist. She attended conferences on archaeology. In the mid-30s, she participated in the excavation of prehistoric sites, the Tripilia site, for example. These interests received a large degree of attention in the novel, where they are articulated by Mariana, the leading protagonist and the author's alter ego, who considers herself, quote, a citizen of the millennia, and for whom the longue durée provides a distancing perspective on the tragic present and allows her to keep faith with humanity. The interest in ancient history would later inspire several of Humena's post-war works. But in the diary, these ideas are articulated in a much sharper manner. The millennial view of cultural development frames the critique of racism and of contemporary nationalism. For example, she dismisses a sense of national identity based on the more recent Christian traditions as, quote, lamentation over lost churches. Her field of vision takes in the civilizations that have existed in Ukraine over several millennia and whose ancient rituals underpin contemporary Christian rites. She says, I cannot make peace with the limited view of the national. I do not walk on the last 10 centuries, as do the nationalists, but wander over the millennia. I see my own people in the Tripilians and in the future citizens of the universe. I want to find a thread that links the primitive and the highly intellectual. Particularly interesting is her focus on the role of women in maintaining communal identities over centuries of disruptive change. Civilization and progress, she says, are dependent on the removal of egoism, the desire to think beyond the present day and beyond the satisfaction of immediate needs. And this aspect of human nature, she argues, has been the achievement of women. It is the result of the nurturing instinct of motherly love and self-sacrifice. Quote, she would not perhaps have considered herself, but having children who are part of her, she found in herself a concern for tomorrow, for provisions for the development of plants into future food. Therefore, there are two poles. The male, separation, egoism, unclasping, destruction of another for one's own benefit, and the female, self-sacrifice, the feeling of unity, love. I'm sorry if the gentleman in the audience is offended, but you can answer this later. And finally, one should add to Jimena's bedrock convictions a strong commitment to honesty, personal integrity, and outspokenness. The very outspokenness that got her into trouble with the Soviet regime in the first place. All these are prerequisites for the kind of clear-sightedness that she admired in the greatest writers. So it's from these positions, I'm laying out the groundwork here, it's from these positions that she heaped scorn, both on the toadyism of Soviet authors, the racism of the Nazis, and the snobbish arrogance of the nationalist intelligentsia. The diary and novel provide a wealth of marvelous eyewitness detail. Detail you will not find anywhere else, because she was an eyewitness. She saw on a day-to-day basis, and she recorded wonderful facts. These details illuminate events. Various historical figures, too, are given quite a bit of space. Olena Peliha, Ulas Samchuk, Arkady Lyubchenko, Leonid Prvomaisky appear in their own, under their own names in the diary and under these thinly disguised pseudonyms, as I said, in the novel. Relations between Ukrainians, Russians, Jews, and returning émigrés from Galicia and the West are keenly observed. However, the main focus is on the fluctuation of public opinion and the population's response to first the initial Soviet retreat, then the arrival of the Nazis, then the massacre in Babyn Yar, and the subsequent return of the Red Army. All this takes place in a swirl of rumor, anecdote, gossip, and newspaper reportage. The author presents the ebb and flow of opinion as a movement of a single organism. It's like Kiev is the hero of the book. The expression of the city's mind, its changing moods and evolving awareness are what she is writing about. She demonstrates the difficulty of establishing facts in a confused situation where there are no reliable sources of information. Both accounts show people struggling to weigh news against rumors and to evaluate personality. However, there are very substantive differences between the diary and the novel. I'd like to focus on one, the depiction of Jews and the issue of anti-Semitism, and to ask how the changes she made in the novel illuminate Jimena's writing. The diary notes the escape of Jews from Kiev of many Jews in the first days of the war. It's clear they often feel like foreigners among non-Jews who resent their relative affluence, which is revealed by their clothing, their behavior, their influential positions, and so on, and their abandoned apartments, which are usually the better apartments, and the fact they are leaving the city's defense to others. This resentment is sometimes phrased as a criticism of non-combatants, but there are other disquieting notes that suggest a deeper animosity and the imminence of violence. The diary's account of the anti-Semitic mood is considerably harsher and a lot less sentimental than the novel's. It documents a rapidly growing, menacing hatred. There is no evidence of the sympathy and pity for Jews that was typical of earlier philo-Semitic literature, the literature that preceded the 20s. No reaching out of hands. For example, one incident, when asked, "Why are you taking so long?" by a harbor worker, an infuriated old Jew snaps back, "Are you getting ready to throw me into the Dnipro?" Those who remain in the city show hostility to all evacuees, but particularly to Jews. While recording these attitudes, the author makes it clear that she herself, like the others, considered the privileged position of Jews has in fact generated much of this opprobrium. She notes the anger directed against those who have, as she says, feathered their nests, grown rich, and are the first to leave. Although earlier quotations that I mentioned were included in the novel, but this one now is not. This is what she says. There is such a taboo placed on the word Jew that one cannot even dare to criticize them, especially in print. For some reason, the actions of a bad communist can be criticized sooner than those of a Jew. You're immediately accused of anti-Semitism for no reason. Now everyone is openly talking about them. However, psychologically, there is pressure. One cannot write about this, that they are cowards and insolent, that they are not going to the front, that they have sullied wonderful ideas, grafted onto society and made bloom the idea of getting a good spot, weaseling one's way out, avoiding, working something out. One Jew explains why Hitler does not like them. It's because Hitler thinks that only the Jews can be the equal of Germans. This is that idea of superiority, of one's exceptional nature. This is chauvinism, but no one dares say so. Now, this quotation is the words of Khomeini. This is not an overheard comment. Such passages are probably an accurate reflection of the mood among many who witnessed the privileged strata's frantic, often unseemly rush to catch boats, trains, and other transport moving east. In the diary, Khomeini describes how she was herself forced to leave on a boat, travel down the Dnipro, but then she jumped ship and made her way back. For patriotic reasons, she wanted to be there to witness, to bear witness to the events, to share the fate of her people, but also she wanted to get away from the Soviet system, from Stalin's regime. So her animosity towards the escaping literary elite, who live well while claiming to represent the common citizen, is presented as a widespread phenomenon that's felt across the board. Back in Kiev, she notes in a passage not included in the novel that the vacated apartments of the affluent are now being taken by working people. Quote, "The Communist Party, with the help of the Jews, has lied itself into a corner, zabrechalasya, and has no authority among the masses, has gone rotten. The people have rushed into a reaction." She also is motivated against personal anger against certain writers, Ilya Stebun, Ivan Sava Holovanivsky, Ivan Ler, who are all Jews, as well as Alexander Kornichuk, the head of the Writers' Union, who is a Ukrainian. And she's upset that it is often these writers who present the public face of Ukraine. They're Jewish. This does not sit well with her. What the reader lacks when reading these commentaries is the sort of perspective that was provided by Grossman, Valery Grossman, in his famous lament over the death of ordinary people in his pamphlet Ukraine Without Jews, written in 1943, which was actually included in the Nuremberg trial. This is just a fragment from it. These are the people that were killed. Old men and women are dead, as well as craftsmen and professional people, tailors, shoemakers, tinsmiths, jewelers, house painters, ironmongers, bookbinders, workers, freight handlers, carpenters, stove makers, jokers, cabinet makers, water carriers, millers, bakers, cooks, and he goes on and on and on. It was a community that should not be stereotyped, is what he's saying. However, Khomeini astutely observes very early in the account how this anti-Semitism, inspired by a sense of social inequality and linked to rural resentment of the city's rich, quickly becomes entangled with low impulses, personal greed, the coveting of property and apartments, and the lust for violence. As the writer witnesses this moral degeneration, her attitude begins to change. When the Germans enter the city, she observes their brutality towards Jews. And at this point, her views undergo a very fundamental reassessment. The propaganda posters caricaturing Jews disgust her and her friends. She is equally appalled by the nationalist newspapers, in particular the Nove Ukrainske Slovo, New Ukrainian Word, which describes all non-Aryans, including Ukrainians, as defective. This is a quote from her. "The newspaper and Shtepa's editorials are aimed at instilling a lack of faith in ourselves, our own powers, a lack of will and a slavish submissiveness, in full belief that our older brother, used to be Russians, now it's Germans, will provide everything good. The Germanic peoples have been quickly promoted to this older brother status. Without them, it seems, through all of history, we would not have made a single step forward. This is part of the colonial mentality that Ukrainians need to get over. And she also becomes impatient with these strange ideas that democracy is a product of Judaism. So this is how she responds. They argue that there is no freedom, that the democratic idea is false, that it deceives people, and the entire liberal democratic movement is pernicious, a weapon in the hands of Judaism's rule, that Jews corrupt society when they bring on a revolution so they can themselves rule. She dismisses these, arguing that there are systems of governing far worse than democracy. These include aristocracy, monarchy, dictatorship, or blind obedience. Initially, therefore, the writer's anger towards Jews is based on their association with the Soviet ruling class. But then it substantially softens when confronted with the behavior of German troops, nationalist emigres, and above all, the shock of the Holocaust. This reassessment is even more evident in the novel, as we'll see in a moment. The most important change is the introduction of a narrative of Jewish suffering and loss in the novel. It's present in the diary too, of course, which records the Babyn Yar massacre of the 29th to the 30th of September, 1941. But the novel introduces several characters, including Rosa, who is the Jewish friend of the main protagonist, Mariana, and whom Mariana tries to protect. These changes indicate an attempt to grapple with the issue of anti-Semitism and complicity in the killing. So Nazi attitudes and those nationalists who share them are discredited. Humana asserts democratic values and solidarity between peoples. The writer bears witness to this destruction of the city's Jews and attempts to give an honest account of what she sees and hears. So in the diary, for example, she already describes old sick Jews being left to die on the street. She records her revulsion at the casual comments people make, such as, "It has become easier to breathe without Jews." And it attempts to rationalize the taking of clothes from Holocaust victims. The following is an overheard conversation. "Jews on one side, possessions on the other. The Germans took the best stuff and passed on the worst, saying, 'Take it, Rus.' But really, when you think about it, does it belong to the Jews? It belongs to all people, because the people worked for it all. What was stolen has now been returned." This is spoken by Zina, who herself was kept in high style by a Jew called Kopelev, who provided her with the finest clothing, much of which he came by during the liberation of Western Ukraine, so-called, 1939-41, at the time of the Hitler-Stalin Pact. But the above conversation is retained in the novel and displaced. It is used to expose increasingly anti-Semitic views of one character called Halina, who continually adapts to whoever is in power. She holds that the Jews have brought persecution on themselves by conducting subversive work and setting fire to buildings. She's a typical conformist who claims at various points to be Russian, Ukrainian, German, a Volksdeutscher, depending on what is convenient, and adjusts her opinions accordingly. The diary does report the arrests of Jews in the weeks after Babyn Yar, and it does so graphically. It shows how mothers and children were dragged along to Babyn Yar, and there's a long passage in which she describes what was happening. These passages were also reproduced in the novel. I want to mention this because they dispel the notion that Humena avoided mentioning Babyn Yar or the Holocaust. There is a website, if you look under Herbert Tiedemann, Tiedemann, and it claims, this author claims, that this account by Humena is an excellent explanation, or excellent evidence of the fact that there was no persecution of Jews, that Jews were not killed, as some kind of Holocaust denier. But I mention it because if you read the novel and if you read the diary, this is just not true. The tone is restrained, but I think this is deliberate. And at the very end of the diary, she explains why she took this restrained tone. The tone, she says, has to be epic philosophical, far from the daily rush, thoughtful, surprised by what everyone finds ordinary. Terrible events that breathe the heat of political situation must be transformed, given an entirely different tone with a broad historical framework. No incitement, no rabid foaming at the mouth, but a solemn bell. This actually is exactly the tone that Grossman took in his stories written right after the war, and in his major novel, Life and Fate, that was published abroad, but actually was not published in Russian in the Soviet Union until after the Soviet Union collapsed. It should also be mentioned that in 41 to 43, it might have been that Humana was not fully aware of the extent of the Holocaust. Many people were not aware of the extent of the killing, the scale of the killing. This only became fully apparent to all observers at the end of the war. And this also probably, having realized this after the war, it probably shaped the novel that she felt she had to write. But there are these moments where you wonder, in the diary, for example, there's one passage which was a drop from the novel. This is what it records. She records this as a conversation. These pogroms, which are even counted as destroying tens of thousands of Jews, will not destroy the Jewish nation, for they have profoundly insulted the Jews, made martyrs of them, placed a crown of thorns on the head of this nation, of which it is unworthy. One character says, the Jews have been forgiven everything, says one Komsomol member, because of the way they have been treated. The peasant worked day and night on their sugar beets and knew no rest, had no time to sleep or wash, saw no sugar. At the same time, some Lea or Chana consumed that sugar in the cities in the most varied forms. But you were not killed, and they were, they the Jews were. Therefore, all the evil the Jews did to us has been justified, precisely because they were killed. An interesting passage was dropped from the novel, as the scale of the killing and dawned on everybody. But the passage suggests a widespread attitude, and it also suggests that this was shared by the author. And it explains the tension in her diary between, on the one hand, horror at the Holocaust and sympathy for the suffering of the Jews, and on the other hand, a residual anger at what she perceives to be the privileged position of the Jews. The author's main problem in the novel was, therefore, to combine these two narratives. And I think this is the key to understanding the novel. An attempt to combine Jewish and Ukrainian suffering. It's difficult and it's a painful subject. Humana's strategy is to link Hitlerism with Stalinism and to juxtapose the horrors of both regimes. And I think for the most part she's successful. Her novelistic purpose, however, is to keep the focus on Ukrainian suffering. To keep the focus on what her people suffered in the 30s and by the end of the war. By the end of the war, they were again treated as boors, as pariahs. As the Germans are retreating, one character in Novelle Ukrainska Slovo says to the secretary, "Boors, I hate them all. There's nothing worse than a Ukrainian. What did they lack under the Tsar? They had pig fat, bread. They could have studied, but they didn't want to. As for the Ukrainian language, what language?" she says. The author fears that under the new Soviet regime, the Ukrainian culture will once more be reduced to a culture lacking a high cultural expression, watered down, sanitized, standardized. I think at least part of her discomfort with this Holocaust theme, therefore, stemmed from the fact that it threatened to destabilize and eclipse this narrative of Ukrainian suffering, which she felt she was obliged to record. After all, it had not been recorded in Soviet publications. It had not been recorded in the West. This whole Ukrainian suffering has been a fairly recent phenomenon, and even now, it has not sort of It doesn't receive popular expression in the Western media. So it was, I would argue, the need to maintain this master narrative of Ukrainian suffering, but to intertwine it with a narrative of Jewish suffering that led to most of the changes introduced in the novel. It's not an easy balancing act. Take, for example, the opening pages of the novel. The war begins, the Germans invade, it's just been announced on the radio, we meet Mariana with her Jewish friends in the apartment of the rabbi, Rebbe, and Clara, who are planning to join the evacuation. The apartment's balcony overlooks Kiev. The interior details suggest a comfortable, dignified life. A milky white tablecloth, crystal glasses, a glistening piano. On the rabbi's request, Mariana agrees to deliver some written materials and photographs to a librarian for safekeeping. Soon after the occupation, Mariana helps her Jewish friend Rosa to hide her identity, and when news of Babyn Yar spreads through the city, she meets a distraught Rosa on the street and tries to explain to her what is happening and to offer her some way of hiding. Babyn Yar in the novel becomes the turning point. Many Kievites suddenly discover that the friends and colleagues whose Jewish background they didn't even know about often have disappeared, and the abstraction, the Jews, suddenly becomes a noun signifying particular friends, colleagues. Petty resentments towards the Jewish population turn to horror in the face of this unfathomable crime. As a result, some characters become violently anti-nationalistic, associating the national cause with the German invasion and the killing of the Jews. There's one climactic scene. It's a furious discussion between Mariana and her childhood friend Vasanta, whose family had been arrested and exiled in the 30s during Stalin's collectivization. But now Vasanta has adopted fierce anti-Ukrainian pro-Soviet views. Mariana, on the other hand, refuses to identify with either regime and hopes for the survival of her people and the eventual return of political sanity. In this way, the novel raises a number of issues that entered public discourse much later in the century. Political conformism, guilt felt by silent witnesses, responses to what's called limit experience, extreme experiences, and the need to construct a personal narrative for even the most traumatic events. I want to just focus on two passages, or two of the strongest passages that I think, and the passages that you could spend a lot of time discussing. One moment encapsulates many of these issues, and it's emblematic of Jewish-Ukrainian relations. It occurs when Mariana's friend Rosa is removed from a public gathering. Rosa and Mariana are present at a meeting of those who have lost their apartments through fire or bombing. Some very well-dressed Jewish women are sitting or lying on tables at the front, which raises complaints. They've taken the best places again, while our children have to stand by the door. Rosa sits with Mariana and holds her hand. Disturbed by the talk of expelling Jews from the city, Rosa leaves the hall for some air. She attracts an admirer, a German soldier called Willy, who is a good-natured lad of 22. He gives her presents, perfume, and his photograph, and he distributes chocolates to the women. These women murmur that the officer should be informed of the presence of Jews. The words, "We will not cover for them, and my children are over there by the door, why can't they sit on the table too?" are overheard. When Willy returns, his attitude has changed. He asks in German whether there are any Jews in the room, and Rosa acts as a translator. When informed that this is indeed the case, he demands their immediate departure. Those sitting on the tables leave in silence without meeting anybody's eyes. An old man hiding under a table is discovered and removed. Throughout all this, Rosa and Mariana hold hands tightly. Willy comes up behind Rosa and lashes her across the back with a whip. She too leaves with head lowered. It's a very powerful passage, and it is very suggestive. To me, the scene represents the lack of support for Jews in a sort of a passive way. The jealousies and social antagonisms that could be easily exploited to drive them out. and the difficulty of maintaining solidarity and protecting Jewish friends, the holding of hands, for example. These are ways in which the novel integrates into the narrative a narrative of Jewish destruction and loss, and sort of this friendship between Jews and Ukrainians, which is is insufficient to prevent tragedy. As Humana's novel drives for closure, it attempts to include all sufferings. The members of Mariana's spiritual family include Ukrainians and Jews. In fact, she searches throughout the novel for like-minded people, people with whom she can speak freely, strong and upright citizens who identify with Ukraine. So the loss of the rabbi, of Clara, of Rosa, represent the destruction of part of this family. At the closing of the novel's first section, Mariana returns to the deserted apartment of the rabbi and Clara. She also spends much of the remaining two sections in the apartment of a Jewish family and then of Rosa's, who's perished in the Holocaust. During this time, she tries to reconstruct the lives of the former occupants to mourn their fate. However, not only has Rosa been murdered by the Nazis, her friend Vasanta, the communist sympathizer, has also been murdered by them. And so has Olena Peliha, the nationalist. Mariana's spiritual family, her imagined nation, includes all these. Indeed, all who through the millennia have lived on the land and suffered its ruins, as she says, colonizations, fusions, cross-pollinations, subjugations. She insists that the basic inhabitants of the land have been rooted to soil, have survived past horrors, and they will survive present horrors. Only the admixtures changed. Whoever wanted rode him, the basic inhabitant, and he survived everything. Mariana, we are informed, continues the life of this eternal commoner, this eternal Ukrainian. In this way, the novel grapples with the issue of who constitutes family, who constitutes nation, how to develop an inclusive identity, how you can construct this inclusive identity. The writer's concept of community stretches racial and national categories to the point of dissolving them. In both the novel and the diary, she invokes the Tripilians, the Scythians, the Polovtsians, the Jews, and other races, all who have lived on the land, all who have left their mark on the people and the culture of today's Ukraine. This view of nation and patria differs from the uncomplicated concept of a homogeneous ethnos, to which some nationalists subscribed. Moreover, Humena does not idolize romantic or abstract notions of the folk. And this is the second passage. This is a very powerful passage that I want to read to you. It's really a remarkable passage. I've never read anything quite like it. It's an eyewitness account from one of the characters narrates this. And this is what he says towards the end of the novel, narrated by a character called Hnat. One day, two very well brought up young men came to the house. They were courteous, rosy-cheeked, well, with innocent blue eyes, obviously from a nice family. They asked very modestly for permission to have breakfast. They were so well behaved and modest that they asked for nothing. They had everything they needed. During breakfast, all men in the small town were ordered to immediately gather in the square, so that the old man had to run off without eating anything. The well-behaved young men offered to help the people of the house by taking breakfast to the father. You can always tell that old, time-honored culture with its respect for elders. They went, and then the women and children were also told to gather. In the middle of the square, all the men of the small town and village were standing in line, surrounded by SS platoons. Every tenth man was selected and told to stand aside. The father was among them. These selected men were to be hanged. The Ukrainian policemen were to do this, but they shook with fear. Their hands trembled. One fainted. Another began to cry. They were unable to do it. Then these two well-behaved young men, with innocent blue eyes, well-bred specialists in hanging, pushed aside the incompetent, useless policemen and expertly, professionally, quickly hung those who had been selected, including the old man. The people, women and children were surrounded to prevent them from running away and to force them to watch their relatives being hanged. There were cries to the heavens, sobbing. They went mad, turned grey. How do you like my story? It is true, because the old man hung by the sentimental, romantic youths was my father. And this is a very powerful and very interesting passage. It's a particularly powerful passage and particularly interesting, I think, for the way it exposes instrumental rationality, the technological approach to the machinery of destruction. Industrialized mass murder becomes possible only once it can be reduced to bureaucratic technical problems, which become the focus of ordinary people involved in its execution. The passage also, of course, raises many other questions concerning human responsibility, motivation, and the capacity for violence. After all, how could these young men act with so little reflection? What had prepared them for such moral indifference? Although this passage does not specifically refer to the killing of Jews, it does support the explanation of the Holocaust as the product of an instrumental rationality. Here, I think, Humena was ahead of her time in putting her finger on an important issue, one that has since been widely debated. It is probably worth mentioning that she does not focus on another view of violence, one that sees it as redemptive, as a way of galvanizing a debased mass. This last view of violence was implied in the works of Dmytro Donsov and the writers grouped around the journal Vysnik in the 1930s. Not all of the Vysnikiutsi, but quite a few. Yuri Sherek, in the late 40s, at exactly the same time as Humena was writing this novel, Yuri Sherek and the Mur group, the writers in Mur, Mestetsky Ukrainsky Ruch, were attacking the Vysnik ideology in a number of articles. Sherek rejected the apotheosis of the will and the ecstasy of faith, as he felt this was born of weak reasoning. Sherek did. In the post-war years, the writers in Mur, of which Sherek was a leader, criticized Donsov's cult of vitality and his amoral enthusiasm, which had prepared the ground for a break with normative forms of behavior. Donsov's writings suggested that national regeneration and redemption must come through violence, and he appeared to sanction extreme transgressions. This is what Dominic Lacapra has called the negative sublime, and identified as a component of Nazi ideology, this Dionysian excess. Humena's position was close to Sherek's, and her depiction of violence in the passage I have cited can be seen as a critique of the sort of license to kill that many may have taken, this is speculation, but many may have taken from Donsov's writings. Humena's writings are the first by a Ukrainian eyewitness account to describe the Holocaust in Kiev. They predate by 14 years Anatoly Kuznetsov's Babi Yar, which caused a sensation when it appeared in English translation in 1970, a year after the author escaped to the United Kingdom. She deserves great credit for portraying public attitudes towards the Holocaust, for problematizing the issue of violence, and the question of who forms part of the nation. These are not issues that have been raised in many accounts. They're not raised in Ulas Samchuk's memoirs or in Arkady Lyudchenko's diary, which is virulently racist and anti-Semitic. Humena's work provides the richest, I think, material for analysis, particularly in the light of recent historical studies. I'm thinking of works like Amir Weiner's Making Sense of War, Shimon Redlich's Together and Apart in Brzezani, Kate Brown's A Biography of No Place. All of these have asked very provocative questions about willing collaborators, silent witnesses, and relations between national and ethnic groups in Ukraine. Humena's account belongs to those intellectuals who are committed to a civic nationalism and a broadly conceived pluralistic culture and identity. These are attitudes, I think, that would find favor with many of today's Ukrainian writers who are concerned with issues of democracy and diversity. And I think by challenging shallow aspects of nationalist mythology, she answers all those who out of a concern with national unity fear the revelation of dark pages or disturbing complexities in national history. Not only, therefore, I would say, are the diary and the novel among the first narratives of the war and the Holocaust in Ukrainian literature, but to this day they still remain among the best and the most readable. Thank you for your attention.